This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Some of this you may find offensive. I really don't care if that's the case. We're not talking about paying an extra couple bucks for a gallon of gasoline. We're talking about the global commodity the entire world runs on.
He was done with this war a long time ago, like after maybe 2 weeks.
You're exactly right about this with the Republicans. I mean, they have tended to be the biggest problem for President Trump over this over the cycle, basically. And I mean, it feels like we're not getting a lot done.
This is huge, potentially affects the nonsense that goes on in places like California.
All right, before we get into the meat and potatoes of our show tonight on I'm Right, we have to do something that we hate doing, but something we feel obligated to do, honoring the fallen, especially those who die in training, those who die outside of combat in military service. They too often get forgotten. We just kind of dismiss it. Oh, that's sad, but we always want to read their names on this show. We just had a B-52 Super Fortress crash, and these warriors lost their lives on it. Colonel Gregory Watson, Lieutenant Colonel Gabriel Estrella, retired Lieutenant Colonel Miles Middleton, Major Alexander Davis, Major Robert D., Major Brad Hovey, Flight Test Engineer Jeremy Smith, Flight Test Engineer Christopher Risher. Terrible. Please keep those families in your prayers. All right. Now let's touch on something we haven't done a ton of on the show, the Iran deal. There are opinions all over the map about doing a deal with Iran. People who understand that Iran is an evil terrorist regime, they see things like, well, billions of dollars flowing into the hands of Iran, and they say to themselves, are we crazy? Did we lose? Did Trump capitulate? What is going on here? So I'm not here to actually give you an opinion on love it or hate it. I'm going to just lay out for you what was going on, what happened, and why it happened. Some of this you may find offensive. I really don't care if that's the case. First, Donald Trump has been desperate for a deal for 2 months. Again, you can save your emails. I don't care. Why do you think he did a ceasefire? He stopped dropping the bombs, did a ceasefire, set up this blockade. And then every day for the last 2 months, we've had, we're almost to a deal. Almost a deal's coming tomorrow, 95% of the way there. And people kept wondering, what's he doing? And Iran would do something belligerent, like launch some drones, or they were throwing mines out in the water, doing all kinds of, you know, Iranian things. And still, Trump, up until the last few days, really didn't do anything back to them. No, they dropped some stuff, but the deal's still on. We're going to do it. Why the desperation? What was Donald Trump worried about? Well, he told you yesterday.
Now, if I did the opposite, if I went out and continued to bomb them for another 4 hours, just bomb the hell out of them, I'd get bad press on that. No, there's nothing I can do. But what this does is it allows the ships to go. If we keep bombing, those ships won't be going. And you're talking about $500, $600, $700 million a day. It's a lot of money. A lot of money. That's why the world is okay. It's liquid. It's fine. Also, we run out of reserves in about 4 weeks. You know, there are reserves all over the world, and we would really run out, and there'll be a time when you wouldn't be able to get it, and you want to see bedlam? So for all those so-called geniuses that want to show me how smart they are, ask them why didn't they blow up General Soleimani. Ask that of the general and couple of other people that I like very much, but boy, are they wrong.
Okay. You can love or hate that answer, but let me explain something. I'm gonna use an analogy to explain something. I have a house. Right? I have a house. Let's say China drops an EMP in my area and all the power goes out. There's no more power. Right? But I have a generator, gas generator that powers my house. I have to start pouring that gasoline into my generator, and my house is lit up. I have lights. I have air conditioning. The kids can turn on the television. But the gasoline is running out. Yes, the lights are still on. The air conditioning is still running. But every single day, I am draining the gasoline reserves. And on the day that generator drinks down the last drop of my gasoline reserves, the lights go out. And the kids who thought everything was fine are going to realize everything was not fine. We were using emergency reserves to stay afloat. That's what the entire world was doing for the last 3 months after Trump decided to bomb Iran. Love it or hate it, the world started tapping into its oil reserves. The United States of America is now at the lowest level with our reserves since 1983. This was Europe. This was all across the globe. So when people who are angry about this thing say something to the effect of, well, it's a couple dollars a gallon, I can deal with a little short-term gas price increase, I'm going to set aside the coldness of that statement. We're not talking about paying an extra couple bucks for a gallon of gasoline. We're talking about the global commodity the entire world runs on. Oil is not just a product. The whole world runs on oil. Everything you have, and I mean absolutely everything, uses oil. It's either an ingredient and or oil was used to haul it. Oil is the global commodity that runs planet Earth. If you suddenly had a scarcity of that product and the price of a barrel of oil goes up to $150, $200 a barrel, we're not talking, well, it's a couple bucks at the pump. We are talking about global recession. We're talking about people dying. Let me ask you something. Did you know because of the recent increase in the cost of oil, they estimate 200,000 people globally have already died? I'm not talking about it costing a little more to fill up your Subaru. We're talking death. That's what was at stake if this kept going. Maybe this makes you feel better. Maybe it makes you feel worse. And I'm not sitting here telling you that I love the deal, that Iran's going to be good to go now. Iran sucks. And there's all kinds of awful stuff in that deal. I understand that full well. I am explaining what Donald Trump was looking at. He was looking at a global recession that would have been our fault. How do you think that would have landed when Europe's oil reserves ran out? Africa, Asia, ours. How do you think that would have looked and landed? We're talking an economic catastrophe that could easily and probably would have killed millions of people. So maybe it's you, maybe you got a friend. Just bomb them all. That's what was at stake here. Okay, so why did Trump do it to begin with? Well, my friend Mike Baker came on the show, and he has a theory I've heard before.
I think he felt, probably because there were a small cadre of individuals around him telling him, you saw what happened in Venezuela. Boy, that sure worked out great. You know, we could do the same thing as combination of military and economic pressure. We can clean up this Iranian regime mess. It's gonna work out well. Because you remember at the very beginning of this conflict, the president was talking about a matter of days, right? And then was talking about we're obliterating their military capabilities. We're decimating their nuclear program. We're going to, get them to stop promoting and supporting terrorist proxies. None of that happened. Look, I believe firmly that the Iranian regime deserves to have the ass kicking of all time and should be gone. But I worry that there was some I don't want to say hubris, but, you know, there was a little intoxication left after the success of that Venezuelan effort, which continues to work in the favor of the U.S. at this point. And I think that kind of led them down this path, perhaps. I don't know that. I know they talked about the intel saying, look, there's an imminent threat here with their nuclear program. You know, that's open to interpretation. Everyone's got a different definition of imminent threat. So why did they do it? I think they were overly optimistic. I don't think they listened to all the input that was coming in from the intel community and the military and the Pentagon. So that's just me sitting on the sidelines being churlish.
So you got to do a deal and wrap it up. Maybe that made you feel better. Maybe it made you feel worse, but I'm right. We'll talk to Jeffrey Tucker about some things in a moment. Before we talk to Jeffrey Tucker, I want to talk to you about your mobile plan. Everyone has a cell phone now. I know you have a cell phone. We all do. I certainly do. You know those big mobile companies, just they're the biggest commie companies out there. They take that money you send them every single month and they fund all the grossest commie causes in this country. If you'd like to test that theory of mine, why don't you go look up your mobile company in Pride Month and see what they're currently doing with your money? My company isn't Pure Talk. My company is led by a Vietnam veteran. They're so patriotic, they hire Americans. Oh, by the way, we're talking about unlimited high-speed data on their network for $34.99 a month. What are you paying right now? Go to puretalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. Well, Jeffrey Tucker, who you know is one of my favorites, obviously, president of Brownstone Institute, he came on the show a little while ago, and we had an interesting discussion. It was almost a side discussion. It wasn't the central theme, but what we were talking about is Trump in COVID, you know, the decision to shut down the country and how that decision kind of got away from him. And he realized at some point in time, maybe this was a mistake. So he's trying to take steps to reverse it. The parallels between that and this whole Iranian mess, which I think is coming to an end. Trump very clearly wants it to come to an end. Anyway, I wanted to continue that conversation for a little bit, amongst other things, with my friend Jeffrey Tucker, again, president of Brownstone Institute. Jeffrey, the more I think about what you and I discussed before, the more I am actually pretty floored by the parallels between those two moments of Trump's two presidencies.
Isn't it strange that, as far as I know, only you and I have spoken about this? You'd think there would be everywhere within the analysis. But yeah, it's a very similar situation. It goes against his instincts. COVID thing. He did not want to lock down. He got surrounded on all sides. Finally, in a frustrated sense of fury, he said, okay, have it your way. Let's see how it goes. It didn't work out. By July, he was done with the whole thing. He demanded that the country open up. He brought in Scott Atlas, got schooled on virology and infectious disease, and said, okay, this COVID thing is a catastrophe. It's got to stop immediately. He wasn't able to stop it because the bureaucrats had taken over by that time. So in this war situation, it's a very similar thing. He promised for a very long time, we're not going to go to war with Iran. We're going to stay out of nation building. We're not going to be using American military power to try to bully other countries into doing our way. That way is the way of catastrophe. We know this from history. And then sure enough, he got surrounded in February on all sides by people yelling at him that he's got to stop Iran. Then he didn't want to do it, but finally at some point he said, okay, fine, we'll have it your way. You know, sent all the bombs and conducted this war. All the things that he was promised did not come true, namely that he could decapitate the regime, kill the Ayatollah, demoralize the elites, the people would rise up and overthrow, right? That was the scenario he had been promised. He realized after just a few days that this was not happening. And even worse, the Strait of Hormuz was closed, driving up the price of gas. And then it turned out our conventional weapons were no, I mean, I think we can say no match for the sort of techno-guerrilla warfare of Iran with their cheap drone technology. And it drove the U.S. crazy. And so he was done with this war a long time ago, like after maybe 2 weeks or something, and has been trying to get out of it. And then, this most recent deal was sort of, he was at the end of his rope. It's like, okay, I should have never done this. And here's the deal I'm making because it's in America's interest to get out of this conflict and get the strait back open and get the price of oil back reasonable. And that'll protect me and protect. And he's very angry now, we're told, with the people who sort of talked him into this, right? I mean, so it's like he treated this war like a failing casino. He should have never bought it, you know? He's going to walk away from it. But yeah, very close parallels with the COVID thing. And the timeline overlaps almost identically in terms of the calendar year. In the case of COVID, it was kind of mid-March to mid-July. In the case of this war, it was late February to mid-June. So, you know, there we are. It's a very similar situation. The only thing I will say about Trump is like these are catastrophic errors he's made. But you know, I don't know how else to say it, but at least he corrects, right? He self-corrects. There's something to say for that. He never admits that he did something wrong, but one thinks that in his heart, and actually in the case of this war, we're told this, and we're told this about the COVID, that he looked at it and said, look, this was this way was a disaster. They told me such and such would happen. It didn't happen, so I'm done. He wants to wash his hands of it. So in a sense, I think maybe he deserves some credit for that. I mean, certainly George W. Bush never really recognized his own failures in the Iraq War and so on. So I'm happy about the way this thing is concluded. Oh, what the other difference between with COVID and this Iran war, he couldn't stop the COVID thing once he started it because the bureaucracy was in control, the administrative state and all of its associated industrial powers were allied against him. So he was just reduced to this tweeting guy, you know, open up the country. Well, he didn't have any mechanisms of control. But in the case of this war, as a commander in chief, he certainly could. He did have the volition, the discretion to end it, to end decisively what he started with equal decisiveness. So in that sense, we have a better solution to this conflict than we ever had with COVID.
Jeffrey, let's talk about the Israeli aspect of this for a moment, because there's something that has jumped out to me, certainly in the past couple weeks, and that is the, not just privately, public stern words Trump and then earlier today, Vice President J.D. Vance had for Israel, parts of the Israeli government. We know Donald Trump cussed at Netanyahu and told him, I'm the only friend you have. And then when challenged on that, Trump admitted that that was a conversation he had. He yelled at him. J.D. Vance today blasting Israel pretty publicly, the people in the government who don't want the thing to end. I get the sense, and I don't know the internal mechanisms or conversations that kick this thing off, but I'm getting a feeling like Trump is laying some of this blame at their feet. Is that crazy?
No, that's exactly what's happening. But yeah, so here's my read on the situation. Trump thought that Netanyahu and the people that surrounded him were sort of rational actors, that they wouldn't blatantly lie to him because the U.S. is the best, I was going to say the best ally in the world. I mean, arguably the only ally in a world that has been completely alienated from attachment to its prior affections for Israel based on what happened in Gaza, right? So the U.S. is sort of stuck by Netanyahu despite everything. It's the only country in the world where Netanyahu can visit and he's cheered by the legislature, right? So you would think under those conditions that Netanyahu would want to protect that relationship as much as possible, one would think. And I think that that's what Trump believed. Like, there's no way this guy could be just making stuff up, because if he's wrong about this, he'll lose the best friend he's ever had, and really, in some sense, the only friend he's ever had. So Trump did not count on the fanatical irrationality of the ideological forces that have been pushed against him, and once he came to fully realize that the fanaticism of the party in power in Israel for its territorial ambitions, you really did swamp its own protection of its special relationship with the United States, and now you're looking at a situation where this negotiation with Iran took place without even consultation of Israel at all. I mean, Israel was sent the agreement after the fact. So this is a gigantic error that Netanyahu, political and strategic error that Netanyahu engaged in. And I think Trump just, you know, he's got a good read on people, and he just assumed there had to be some kernel of truth to what Netanyahu was saying about how easy it would be to topple the Iranian regime, or else he wouldn't be in the White House Situation Room saying this. But he was wrong about that. And I think that's been part of what Trump's been dealing with. Like, he blatantly and aggressively lied to me, so I have no obligations to hold my tongue at this stage. I'm gonna tell him and the whole world what I think. But it definitely seems to open up a new chapter in U.S.-Israel relations that is not so uncritical, I would say.
I guess I'll ask an uncomfortable question this way of you, Jeffrey. It's hard to imagine the alliance between the United States of America and Israel going on for a real distant future. I'm not saying it's going to end tomorrow or something like that, but the left, they all hate Jews now, right? So they're completely gone. And on the right, an increasingly large percentage of the right is kind of done with it. I'm not talking about, you know, being Jew-hating Nazis or something like that, but just kind of done with getting involved with the whole thing, and they want to be rid of it. Am I crazy?
I think that's exactly what's happening, and I think Netanyahu really underestimated the impact that his move on Gaza, with the aggression that it took, and the number of lives that were lost, and the impact that would have on U.S. Israeli relations. I mean, we think of ourselves as a good people, a good country, that is quick to call out evil when it exists, and the level of patience, and I would say like tolerance for Israel's conduct with its war against its neighbors, and in particular Gaza, and then once it started, bombing Beirut and so on, and its moves on southern Lebanon, it just really has become too much. You know, at some point, special relationships become strained. And I would say, like, you're right about the left. I think the left for a very long time, and I can't say this for sure because I'm not really moving in those circles, but I think for a very long time, a central principle of the left has been to dissent against this U.S. Israel alliance, right? So that's kind of baked into the heart of the sort of the tribe of the left. But now that's mutated over to the right, which has traditionally had this kind of this nonchalant sort of acquiescence, like, oh yes, they're our greatest friends or whatever. Okay, that's great. But when that friendship is abused at the expense of U.S. Prosperity and also our moral high ground in the world, that becomes a real problem. So in particular, speaking on the issues of the prosperity point, the low price of gas was something that Trump could count as a real achievement of his administration. I mean, that was just a very clear case. It was extremely high under Biden. It fell dramatically under Trump, and he was taking credit for that. The war reversed that trajectory, and even by several years. I mean, the price of gas is a particular pain point for Americans. When it started reaching, you know, $5 and $6 and higher, it just became intolerable. When the realization came that we had to open the strait, or else face a complete depletion of our strategic petroleum reserve, and high gas prices reversing this great achievement of the Trump administration going into the midterms, and Trump is forced to choose between, you know, going along with Israel's demands to continue the war, and expanding their territorial ambitions and so on, and making a deal with Iran, they put him in a very difficult place, and that is not unknown, and people are aware of this. And it's true that today, there are neoconservatives that are screaming about this whole thing, but I'm just, my plea is for a little bit of rationality. I mean, this is not a war that Americans are going to be patient with over the long term, because we're just paying too high a price, and it makes us very uncomfortable as a nation to be allied with war policies that seem inconsistent with our national ideals. That's just truth.
Jeffrey, brilliant as always. Come back soon, sir. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You know, we didn't even get to the COVID stuff, and all that stuff was terrible, but I personally, I got at least one win out of that whole COVID disaster, and that was that I discovered chalk. You see, during COVID, when America's corporations and everyone else lost their mind and locked down this and all this other insanity, there's this wonderful company of anti-communists who sell the best natural herbal supplements I've ever had in my life. They stood up and they said, no, this is insane. Take your stupid mask off. We're not going to stand 6 feet away from everybody. Go outside and get some exercise. Just be healthy. And I'll tell you what, it was such an appeal to me that I got to know Chalk really well. And I've been taking a male vitality stack from Chalk for 4 years now. My T levels are through the roof. I feel like $1 million. I sleep better. I work better. Life is better. I want you to experience that. Go try it. 60 days, 90 days. You're about to feel like a different person. They have stuff for men, women, young, old, whatever you're looking for. Chalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. Well, look, you know how much I hate to pat myself on the back. I'm kidding. That's like my favorite thing in the world to do. But I told you 2 years ago, I told you right here on this show that the GOP Senate was going to be a problem. It was going to be a problem for Trump. It was going to be a problem for the America First agenda, because a lot of these scumbags, they hate you. They secretly hate you behind closed doors. Joining me now, Ashley Bracefield, a really solid senior politics reporter at the Daily Caller. Ashley, we can't even get the SAVE Act passed when 80% of the country wants it. Like, half the Democrats want it.
Yeah, well, I have to correct you off the bat. SAVE America Act, Jesse. You're exactly right about this with the Republicans. I mean, they have tended to be the biggest problem for President Trump over this over the cycle, basically. And I mean, it feels like we're not getting a lot done here in Washington, which is not usual if you've been up here, worked up here, lived up here. And to the American people, that's a no shocker. So, I mean, with the Save America Act specifically, what it does, election integrity, legislation, everyone lived through the 2020 election, you would think it's a no-brainer passage bill for the Republicans.
Okay, can you maybe, because you know the inner workings of Washington, D.C., certainly better than I do, having to work in the belly of the beast, can you explain this to people like me who get confused? It surely benefits Republicans to have the Save America Act passed. So what's the disconnect here?
Well, the disconnect is that some detractors, and you know, you can name names, you can go Mitch McConnell, there was Susan Collins for a while, she came over to the side that supports this, as well as Lisa Murkowski, Tom Tillis, excuse me, of North Carolina, who all are kind of detractors in this. And Tillis and McConnell tend to be in the same camp here and saying that this bill would nationalize elections, which they find problematic. What this bill does, you know, there's kind of five pillars that were passed by the House bill. There is an extended version, so two versions. But I mean, Senator Mike Lee is kind of the biggest component here of sponsoring this. And basically what it would do would be, you know, showing voter ID at the election, at the polls. It also has a women's sports component. So it's really just like common sense pillars here. And even John Thune was on a Fox hit with Brett Baer the other day talking about those five pillars. And so, I mean, they know them. They're pretty common sense. He admitted it himself. But it basically the issue is, though, that these small segment of senators, they don't have the 60 majority vote. So when that comes in, they can't, you know, conquer cloture in that instance. And therefore, it would have to be filibustered. Their problem is that the filibustering would be too long and it would take too much hard work. I think that's basically the answer we've gotten over the last year that we've been discussing this bill.
Well, I'd certainly hate for them to have to do any hard work. Okay, you have an exclusive with the Daily Caller about John Thune. How big of a fan of Trump is John Thune?
I think that's a great question at this point. I don't think the relationship at the beginning of this administration to now is the same as it was. I don't know if there's a, you know, hatred from John Thune to President Trump. But I mean, there is an aspect, especially in this exclusive, that, you know, John Thune allegedly came out in a lunch meeting on Wednesday with GOP senators present and said, you know, these GOP senators will not vote for the Save America Act because they hate Trump too much. So there's obviously this idea floating around the Senate, and all the senators know it. And he just said the obvious part out loud. And, you know, I think they put forward this, you know, stonewall of the GOP senators are all in this together. But I think there is some, you know, it's pretty obvious at this point that the Save America Act has caused some breakage amongst party lines within the party. And I think it's trying to not put too much pressure on certain senators so they can get other legislation passed. That's what the Senate Majority Leader's job is to do. But I think you can come to a point where this is milestone legislation. The president himself has said he wants it passed, or he wants it, you know, attached to FISA, whichever you want to get into. But I think you have the leverage as the speaker, or the Senate Majority Leader, excuse me, to put pressure on these members, whether it be through leverage, through campaign funds, being the Senate Majority Leader, public opinion on them. So he doesn't seem to want to do that. And that's been the trend that you've been seeing, and why he continues to say, we just don't have the votes. He could force the votes with a talking filibuster.
Okay, so I'm glad you brought up FISA, because that's exactly where I was going next. Donald Trump says attach FISA to the SAVE Act. Okay, that's all well and good to want that. I personally hate FISA myself, but that's another story. That's all good to want that. Is Donald Trump committed enough to that to say, I'm vetoing any FISA that doesn't have a SAVE Act attached to it?
Well, from, you know, a lot of the Truth Social posts he's put out, it seems like he stayed on that line, and he's been there for a few months now. So the pressure, I think, is on John Thune, and that's where you're seeing the split between the majority leader and the president, because he's not coming through on that promise. And, you know, I think a lot of senators, especially in the GOP, really want FISA. You know, you can see who are the ones that are really, you know, for it. There's obviously those in the House that are against it. But I mean, you're basically toying with the Fourth Amendment, you know, promise here in order to get the Save America Act, one for the other. And I don't think a lot of the base, especially the grassroots, are for that. But I mean, you know, it depends on which one you want more, I guess, at this point. And the president's willing to, you know, put that on the line at this point. And I do think it's an interesting change of heart by the president due to the fact that FISA was used against him and is, you know, during his time as he wasn't president, to spy against him. So that's the question. I think that surprised a lot of people when he came out and did that. But it seems like he's willing to put it on the line. It's whether the supporters in the base are also.
All right, let's talk about the state with the best banana pudding in the country, Georgia. Why are we not getting redistricting in Georgia?
Oh, yes, my home state. It tends to cause problems, if you haven't noticed, over the past few years with Brian Kemp and President Trump going at it. And of course, now you're seeing quite the fight in the Senate GOP race and the gubernatorial race just happened. But along with the redistricting specifically, I mean, you saw a bunch of southeastern states take this up. Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi was a possibility, South Carolina, Georgia was also a possibility. And, you know, Governor Brian Kemp, who is very popular within the state, came forward and wanted to do a special session to get that done. They decided against it. I will say it wasn't a shock to me. I mean, you're facing up against two pretty competitive races, both in the Senate race and the gubernatorial race, with Keisha Lance Bottoms running for governor, and then John Ossoff, who is popular amongst constituents in Georgia because of his constituent affairs. So I think that is one of the problems as to why the redistricting didn't go forward there. But I do think there's, you know, probably discussion within the state legislature of, you know, why that didn't go forward. I mean, President Trump won in 2024 that state. So I think there was an expectation that they take it up with the leadership of Brian Kemp. And he came out yesterday, you know, discussing the state legislator's decision and, you know, disapproved of it. I think it will set Georgia up for kind of failure going into place things like 2028 for Republicans. And that, you know, they were kind of leaning on a lot of these states in order to win back the House along with the Senate in a lot of ways.
Ashley, come back soon. I appreciate your great work. All right. American Financing does great work. What do they do? Well, this is for you if you're carrying this high interest debt around like an elephant on your back. It feels like you're never going to get out, doesn't it? If at best, you can make the minimum payments, but you're paying 20, 30%. What do you do? You'll never make enough money to pay that off, right? Well, do you have a mortgage? You know, American Financing is here to carve a path forward for you and get that elephant off your back. They help get people out of high interest debt, people just like you. And I know you're probably sitting there thinking to yourself, not me, it's too bad, you don't understand. No, they've heard it all. They've heard the worst stories you can imagine. That's what they do, is help people like you. Go to AmericanFinancing.net/Jesse. We'll be back. Well, let's wade into the legal arena, shall we? Because we seem to keep picking up wins with the courts. I know every day there's a new headline out there about some dirtball commie judge stopping deportations or something like that. But overall, I feel like we've been notching some pretty solid victories. But then again, I'm a moron and Bill Jacobson is really smart, so we should probably ask him about that. Joining me now, Cornell University law professor, my friend Bill Jacobson. Bill, did we get another win in the Supreme Court? What?
There was another win today. It's a little bit narrow, but it's a Second Amendment win. The issue is whether the government could prosecute under a federal statute somebody who possessed a gun and admitted to being an occasional marijuana user. And that was the question. The federal statute allows a prosecution for someone who possesses a firearm while using controlled substances as defined. And so the court looked at it and the court said, well, we're not going to really treat occasional marijuana use as falling under the statute. And they hearkened back to what was permissible when the Second Amendment was passed and what exceptions have been received by the courts over the years. And the government used the habitual drunkard exception to the Second Amendment. That's actually the term that's in the decision. It's a term which, of course, applies to many of our politicians, but what was an occasional marijuana user, the equivalent at the time the Second Amendment was enacted of a habitual drunkard. And the court said no, that you have no proof that the person was actually intoxicated at the time he possessed the weapon, no indication that he was rendered, you know, unable to function normally because of occasional marijuana use. And of course, then Alito, in a concurring opinion, this was unanimous, there were no dissents, said, well, you know, using marijuana nowadays is kind of similar to using alcohol at the time the Second Amendment was enacted. So merely using it is not enough. You would have to show some sort of impairment, ongoing impairment. So yeah, it's a win. It's incremental. You know, these things add up, but this restricts states' ability to some extent to deprive people of their Second Amendment rights merely because they use what is now a common, and in most states, in 40 states, perfectly lawful recreational drug.
Bill, does this give me a win, right? I mean, if I don't touch marijuana, why should I care about this? Is there something, or at least something down the road, that gives someone like me a win out of this?
Well, with all things, when the government tries to infringe your rights, it pushes as far as it can go. And so the more roadblocks you can put there, the less likely they're going to try to invoke prohibitions and invoke prosecutions of people in other areas. But technically speaking, this only protects occasional marijuana users who have not been shown to have a continuing ongoing impairment because of the drug. And now if they had caught the guy while using it and he was all stoned out and he had a weapon, this might have been a different case. But they didn't have that evidence, and that's not what the accusation was.
Don't do drugs, kids. All right, Bill, birthright citizenship. You know, I've asked you about it 1,000 times. I never have gotten warm fuzzies from you that we're going to get a good ruling, the one I want out of this whole thing. But where is it all?
Yeah, well, we're still waiting for the birthright citizenship decision. I was hoping it would come by tomorrow, by today. Tomorrow is Juneteenth, the celebration of the free of when the slaves in Texas learned they had been freed. And the 14th Amendment, as it comes to birthright citizenship, is very much related to the freeing of slaves. And was the 14th Amendment more limited, that it was meant to provide citizenship for freed slaves and their children? Or was it broader, as a lot of people seem to think, which is anybody who's born on the territory of the U.S. automatically becomes a citizen, even if their parents are here illegally, even if they're here on a tourist visa, even if they're just passing through, even if they give birth at a stopover on a flight that stops in Chicago, all those people. So that's really what it means. So it would have been very significant if the decision came out on the eve of Juneteenth holiday, because it revolves around the rights of freed slaves.
All right, let's talk mail-in ballots, because this one is very important. I mean, honestly, this one may be all important. Do we have something coming there?
We do. I mean, this is huge, potentially affects the nonsense that goes on in places like California, at least in federal elections it will affect it, which is that what does Election Day mean? Is Election Day election season? So as long as they're postmarked, or some other evidence they were put in the mail by Election Day, even if they arrive a week later, that counts? Or do they have to be received by the day of the election? And so that's what it comes down to. What does Election Day mean in terms of the statutes and in terms of the law as to voting? And is it voting month? Is it voting season? This does not involve, by the way, early voting. That's not one of the issues. Nobody's saying a state can't allow you to vote a week before Election Day. The question is, can you count ballots that are received after Election Day? And that's going to be huge, because this is such a massive problem. It's a massive problem, I think, legally, but it's also a massive problem in terms of public trust in the electoral process. Even without proof of mail-in fraud, it just doesn't look right when almost every single election that is swayed in Democrats' favor comes after, you know, the Election Day. I mean, I can't think of, and there might be an example, but I can't think of a single Republican who has made up ground and swung into the lead based on ballots received after Election Day. And so this will just have a huge impact, because Democrats rely heavily on mail-in ballots.
Yeah, I'm sure that's just a coincidence. Well, Bill, speaking of the Supreme Court, I want to finish up with this. I have to ask about Democrat plans to pack the Supreme Court. Now, Democrats, some kooky left-winger talking about packing the Supreme Court, that's been going on for my entire 44 years on this planet. That's nothing new. But I can't help but notice that chatter is picking up, and it appears to be a lot more mainstream now than it used to be. Do you think they would seriously do this if they got the presidency and the Senate?
I think they'd try. I think it's going to be a question that, as crazy as some of the Democrat senators are there going to be enough that they could stymie such a move? It would be, you know, we have kind of mutually assured destruction. Neither side does that, because you know, if you can do that, the next time the other side gets power, they can up the ante. And if you want to increase it now from 9 to 12, well, when we get in power, we'll increase it from 12 to 24. I mean, it could be an endless cycle of retribution. And even rational Democrats have shied away from that. But you're absolutely right. Things have gone so far to the left in the Democrat Party. They're espousing positions we would have thought were insane just a few years ago, and the packing the Supreme Court. So I think they're going to make a try for it. I don't know whether it'll get off the ground, and I certainly can't predict whether it would be successful.
All right, I lied about that being the last question. Real quick, is Kathy Hochul in trouble about Medicaid stuff?
Well, I don't know if she personally is. The Department of Justice has sued the state of New York because they created this entity to kind of funnel $10 billion a year in Medicaid funding through this entity, and the entity was not properly run. There was allegedly a lot of siphoning of funds. I don't think it's going to reach her personally, but certainly it's another blight on how states are running this. We've seen it in Minnesota. We've seen it elsewhere. The fraud is just so rampant that it will have an impact. I don't know that she's personally involved in it.
Bill, appreciate you, brother. Come back. Light in the Mood, next. America's 250th birthday is coming up, and because of that and just my natural state of things, I didn't think it was possible for me to feel any more patriotism than I currently do. I'm pretty sure if you cut me, it would just be red, white, and blue. That's how patriotic I am at this moment. But I was wrong about not feeling more patriotic, because this took it to a new level. Delicious, sweet, cinnamon, molten hot lava in your mouth. I love this country. I'll see you tomorrow.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty on demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty on demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.